The CIA man explained that he had watched them pouring over the border, heading for Peshawar. Some came from valleys where foreigners had never gone, where the language they spoke might be known to no one else in the world. Usually there were no telephones or radios, not even postal delivery. But somehow they had all gotten word that Peshawar was the Mecca of the Jihad, the place to go for weapons. They came, not knowing what Afghans elsewhere were doing, all moving in the same direction, mystically organizing themselves into small bands that somehow, when it was all added up, turned into a strangely coherent guerrilla force. The Mujahideen were moving on foot and on horseback across Afghanistan. They were bringing their families to Pakistan. The heads of the clans were arriving with their sons and nephews, their cousins and brothers, all looking for guns to return as family and village military units. Hart had no illusions about these people, most of whom were Pashtun tribesmen. He knew how stubborn they were, how primitive and impossible to reason with, how foreign the concept of unity was to them, how brutal they could be with their prisoners, if they took prisoners. To Hart, ever the Cold War strategist, there was a simple equation. As long as the Mujahideen were prepared to pay almost any price to kill Russians, it was a heaven-sent opportunity for America to help them against the common foe. Charlie Wilson had paid careful attention to what Howard Hart said, and at the outset he had been impressed. "I felt better about Howard after listening to him," Wilson recalled years later. "I could see then that he had an enthusiasm for the fight, but it was a different fight than I had in mind. His idea was to be a burr under the saddle, an extreme nuisance, and he seemed very enthusiastic about this, but he never envisioned killing the beast." The fact was, in Howard Hart, Charlie Wilson was confronting a CIA mindset that had long before grown accustomed to fighting lost causes. There had been two agency successes always cited in the books, the government overthrows in Iran in 1953 and Guatemala in 1954. But those were thunderbolt wonders pulled off with smoke and mirrors, golpes, as they call them in Latin America. The other interventions had invariably been grim affairs designed to hold the line against communism by launching spoiling actions all over the globe. Any officer who permitted his emotions to run loose in this cruel arena where the containment game was being played could have had his heart broken every year. All those sad campaigns to overthrow Sukarno, the colossal failure of the Cuban operations, the long and hopeless war in Indochina. It had almost become the trademark of the CIA's operations division to fight and lose and finally be exposed and then mocked and vilified in the press, in Congress, and even at home by their children. In late 1982, the suggestion that the CIA inflame the Afghans by giving them enough weapons to seek a victory over the Red Army would have sounded preposterous to Hart. No expert anywhere believed the Mujahideen had a chance against the limitless reserves of men, armor, and air power of the country that had been willing to sacrifice over 10 million lives to destroy Hitler. So when Wilson announced to Hart that money was no object, and that he would personally see to it that Congress appropriated whatever amount Hart wanted for the Mujahideen, the station chief was suddenly alarmed. "God protect us from our friends," he thought. At that very moment, back in Washington, liberal Democrats in Congress were in an uproar over a Newsweek cover story about the CIA's latest secret war in Nicaragua, and here was this well-meaning fool, all puffed up and ready to tell the world that the CIA needed millions more for a war against the Red Army, that fortunately no one seemed to even know was being fought. Hart figured Wilson was the kind of politician who might just succeed in compromising the entire operation, all in the name of rescuing it. "I looked at him as a very dangerous man who could get me in serious shit if I wasn't careful. I knew that Charlie was trying to draw me into some kind of statement that he could use. It was a trap I was not prepared for. I said, 'Wait a minute, I have a risk of going outside my channels of reporting here.'" It was hard also for Hart not to be offended by the congressman's thinly veiled implication that he was not thinking big enough and that the CIA was dragging its heels. This infuriated him because he believed, with some justification, that he had almost single-handedly taken the CIA into an involvement far deeper than anyone at the agency had imagined possible just a year before. Whatever this overeager congressman might believe, there was a real war going on now in Afghanistan, and the reason why so many coffins were going back to the USSR had nothing to do with Charlie Wilson. It was because of what Hart had pulled off the previous year in Bangkok at the agency's annual South Asia Chiefs of Station meeting. Like so much else to do with the CIA, that meeting had been one of those invisible events no one ever hears about. But to Hart, Bangkok was the watershed event of the Afghan War. That was when he had convinced the agency to take the risk of escalating. For Hart, Bangkok had been like a class reunion. Near East Division Chief Chuck Cogan was the headmaster who, along with his deputy, John McGaffin, presided over this annual gathering of spy chiefs from Turkey, Iran, Iraq, India, and all the other stations of South Asia. The meeting was an exotic bazaar of spies with exotic stories to tell. The station chiefs from Tehran and Baghdad were there with stories from the Iran-Iraq War, where over 1 million Muslims had already gone to their graves. The man from Delhi had the latest on the increasing dangers of nuclear war between India and Pakistan. Sri Lanka was descending into absolute hell. The Kurds were stirring in northern Turkey. But early on, Cogan and McGaffin split from the crowd to meet privately with Hart. The three were part of that select world of the CIA's Directorate of Operations that Gustav Rakatos could never quite join, and as Hart sat down to brief them, it was with the ease that comes from belonging to the same family. Charlie Wilson and Avrakatos would later unite in hatred of Chuck Cogan, whom they came to see as the obstacle preventing meaningful assistance to the Mujahideen. But Howard Hart adored Cogan and everything he stood for. Years later, looking back at that moment in Bangkok when he, Cogan, and McGaffin had sat weighing the fate of the Afghan resistance, he figured that they represented just about everything that was right about the United States, and particularly everything that was right and honorable and important about the agency's clandestine services. "We trusted each other," Hart said. "John and I were two of Cogan's bright young men. We were cut out of the same mold. We dressed the same way. We had the same social confidence. For Christ's sake, McGaffin and I went to the same prep school together. And Chuck was so supportive. He always called me Howard of Afghanistan. He was a GS-18, the equivalent of a 3-star general, and a division chief. He was one of the barons of the Directorate of Operations, as we laughingly called ourselves.